President Clinton's vision, and one which I share deeply, is public service happens regardless of sector. You could be mayor, you could be senator, you could be president, you're a public servant. You could be an engineer, but the work that you're doing is focused on how do we better the lives of our underserved communities.
Hey, it's Nate DeSaro, and welcome to Titans of Industry, the podcast where I talk to industry leaders and innovators who are at the top of their game and leading the pack in their fields, uncovering some of the best stories in today's business landscape.
In this episode, I had the opportunity to sit down with Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, the Dean of the Clinton School of Public Service. We discuss her journey from Arizona to Arkansas and how she became the public service leader she is today. As someone who is well-versed in political strategy as well as social justice, Victoria shares her insights on the complex issues facing our society today and how public service leadership is the key to success. She has a huge passion for serving her community as well as big plans in store for the future. Now, let's get to the episode. But before we do, let's talk about content strategy and video for marketing your business. Our team at Content Titan is committed to great storytelling no matter what industry you're in. It's crucial to engage, entertain, inform, and captivate your audience, and video is the best way to do it. Having worked with people and organizations of all shapes and sizes, our team has the experience to deliver the right content at the right price. We are easy to do business with, and we know how to get you results. Visit contenttitan.co to learn more. Now here's the episode with Victoria DeFrancesco Soto. Well, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, did I get all that right?
It's long, but you nailed it.
The Dean at the Clinton School of Public Service. So I just want to start by kind of giving me some insight how you ended up in Little Rock, Arkansas.
So I was born and raised in southeastern Arizona. I'm a borderlands kid, I'm a desert kid, so never in a million years would I have imagined that I would have ended up here in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'll go through what happened in the middle, but it really is the dream job. It is where I needed to be, and it's where I wanted to be. In terms of what brought me to Little Rock, I'm a nerd at heart. I was, you know, so
join a club.
I was that student council nerd starting in middle school and seventh grade, and very early on realized that I love civic engagement, that I love public service, that this was a passion of mine. When I went on to college, I formalized that nerdiness in doing political science, and I further formalized that nerdiness in going on and doing my graduate work in political science. So I went that route and studied politics and policy and public service, and I was doing what I needed to do. I got the great first job, and then I realized, oh my gosh, this is really far removed and really lonely, and it's not working with folks in the community and being engaged. I love the classroom stuff, I love the research, I love the nerdiness of it, but I really miss that engagement that you get when you work in organizations and when you're doing field service. And so I started seeking out opportunities within universities and academic settings where I could bridge those two passions. Because for folks who know about academia, there tends to be a town-gown divide. There's people over here in the universities doing good work and people in the communities doing good work, but there's rarely a really intentional bridge between the two. And I was like, there should be a bridge, so I'm gonna start building it. Okay, so most people thought I was crazy, but in my academic pursuits, for personal reasons, also professional reasons, I ended up going to the University of Texas at Austin to the LBJ School, which was a public affairs school, is a public affairs school, and they were very open to playing with that vision. So I was able to, through the support of the leadership of the school, to build out an Office of Civic Engagement that brought the best of the both worlds. So I was teaching students about civic engagement and policy and immigration and you name it, but also pairing them with mentors and organizations where they could learn on the ground. And so I was kind of building that out on my own and starting to connect with other folks who are doing that. And then out of the blue, I get an email inviting me to apply to the deanship at the Clinton School. I had heard about the Clinton School, but I didn't really know what the Clinton School was about. And as I did my research, I go, holy moly, this is it. This is me. This is an institution that President Clinton envisioned that would marry field service in the classroom, that he wanted his students to learn by doing, in kind of a big broad overview of the Clinton School. Over a third of our curriculum is field service based, meaning outside of these four walls. And I was like, I better get this, because if I don't, I'm going to be crushed. So long story short, we're here. And that is how I ended up in Little Rock, which, by the way, I think is such a fabulous community and a hidden gem. And I've made it my personal pursuit to take it out of hiding, at least the Clinton School, and for students to know what an incredible school and community this is.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because previous to 1991 or 92, when Clinton became governor, Arkansas was not known for anything positive, or Little Rock specifically, was not known for anything real positive. And, you know, when he went to the White House, when I travel the country and people say, where are you from? And they're always like, Little Rock, Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes up. And then if they're a little wiser to Arkansas as a whole, they'll say, oh, Walmart, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the other part of the state. But those are the two things people globally kind of recognize about Little Rock / Arkansas. And but there's so much more. And you know, I have the privilege of telling stories of some of the greatest people that have ever come out of or serve in Arkansas, and it's amazing how many cool things and great stories there are here. So for those who might not be as engaged in what public service is as a quote-unquote industry, right? This podcast is called Titans of Industry, so when we talk about public service, break that down to people that are like, wait, isn't that just politics? What, you know? So to me, it's kind of the difference between religion and spirituality, right? It's kind of the...
I like that metaphor. And so public service, and again, I'm going to go back to our founder, to the namesake of the school. His vision was a school of public service, as opposed to a school of public administration or a school of public policy or a school of public affairs, of which there are many. And the reason he pushed back against that was because these other schools have a very direct pipeline. Public administration, you go into government. Public policy, you go into that kind of think tank, nonprofit world. President Clinton's vision, and one which I share deeply, is public service happens regardless of sector. You could be mayor, you could be senator, you could be president, you're a public servant. You could be an engineer, but the work that you're doing is focused on how do we better the lives of our underserved communities. You could be an MD, you can be an artist. How do you use art in the community to connect and bring folks together? So public service, and I know you're absolutely right, people think public service and they automatically think politics or city government, city works, bureaucracy, right? The B word.
And people often refer to as our politicians as public servants
public
and vice
servant.
Versa. So,
and that's why I am very purposeful in saying public service leaders, not public servants, because you can be a leader in public service. You can be a businessman. I mean, one of our alums is the co-founder of a bank, of a community bank. So public service is about how do you serve the greater good? How do you serve a community? And you can do that in a variety of different ways. And that's something that I'm very excited to work with our students in doing that, because there are no two students who are alike and their trajectory. So public service as a field, we're the first school in the nation to have a master's in public service. Public service as a field is about a toolkit. It's about what are the skills that you need to lead regardless of sector. So there's some data analysis in there. There's communications, there's program planning, program evaluation. There's that field service work. But it really is, it's not constrained by a sector boundary.
I love that. So let's back up a little bit. You have an interesting background that I think gives you a unique perspective that allows you to speak into the lives of Americans, if you will, and people going into that field. So From my understanding, you mentioned you're a border kid. Mother from Mexico?
Mother from Mexico, yes.
So how does that influence, again, for people, you know, Arkansas is based in the middle of the country. There's no coast, there's no bordering country, there's nothing else to for us to really connect to, right, on the borders. And so, unless you count Texas and Oklahoma being separate countries, but which they kind of are, but how do you grow up in a world where you're so close and connected to a completely different culture than the quote-unquote American culture, you know?
So I grew up on the border, so very much, and also I'm part Mexican. My mother's from Mexico, so I always had a very strong Mexican influence in my life, Northern Mexican. But I happened to grow up in this microcosm of a military town. So at the time in Arizona, Arizona's grown a lot since I was a kid, but it was the most diverse county in the state because of the large military installation. So I grew up with African American peers. I grew up with Asian American peers. I grew up obviously with Mexican peers. I grew up with, you know, folks who, you know, they grew up, their parents were ranchers, cattle ranchers, and folks who were in the military. So I had this background where diversity was normal for me, and diversity writ large, both in terms of race, ethnicity, gender, socioeconomic status, politics, you know, because it is rural Arizona at the end of the day, but it, you know, it did have components of R's and D's. So I think I was, at the time I hated it, right? Because it was like this small town in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have malls, we didn't have stuff. But now I have grown to appreciate how lucky I was and that I grew up in this very unique context that allowed me to appreciate diversity regardless of where I went, because I've bopped around a lot. You know, I've lived in North Carolina, I've lived in New Jersey, I've lived in Michigan, I've lived in Texas, I lived in Chicago, now I live in Little Rock. So what that has allowed me to do is I get to a place like Little Rock and I embrace the diversity of this region, of the folks from, you know, across the state, because I think it's really interesting to see the diversity around the region, but also the diversity that comes because of UAMS. And a lot of the foreign scholars that we have, people from abroad who come and study here and sometimes stay here. In terms of my background, personal and professional, my research was in immigration, was in Latino studies. There is a thriving Latino community here. It may not be as big as what you see in a Texas or a California, but it is growing. And I think that this is really the trend of the New South, is a diverse mix of Black, white, brown, Latino, Asian American. So I think that's very exciting to be in a place where the population continues to diversify. And I'm here, I'm on ground, I'm at ground zero.
Yeah, that's awesome. So my background, I was born in Little Rock, but I grew up in Texas. So I have to claim Texas as
I'm Texan by marriage, so okay.
You understand the—
I do.
The outsider, but I'm kind of from there. So. But I grew up in a high— I went to public schools, and I consider myself very lucky. And having, you know, obviously experiencing life, you realize how lucky you are when you go to a school that's full of diversity, but you don't know it, right? At the time, you have no idea, A, how lucky you are, and B, that diversity should be normal, right? Because if when you meet people who didn't grow up in that environment, all of a sudden, they don't see the world the way you do, right? And you get that completely. And so, as you guys do the work you do here, talk to me about the divide of how do you influence people to be public servants but not fall into the political trap, if that makes sense?
Public service leaders.
Public service leaders. Yes.
So the first semester that the students are here, they do two things. Aside from kind of the whole range of classes, but two of those are very intentional in pushing against that, let's fall into our natural camps. The first is we put them in practicum teams. So the first year of the Clinton School Experience, we split our students up into small groups, groups of, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5, and they work with partner clients. That can be, you know, a school district in Little Rock, or it can be a nonprofit, Arkansas Advocates, or it can be a a business. And so having them get into a situation where they have to engage, because it's really easy to point fingers and say, oh, I don't like those types of people when you're kind of in this insulated bubble. But we put them together in groups and they're actively in the community working with partners from the get-go because we think it's important for you to be there, because it's harder to be critical of someone if you're sitting across from them or working with them. So that's one of them, the field service component. The second is, what I would say is one of our distinguishing factors is communications as a core course, not as an elective, but communications, and more specifically, the faculty member we have is fantastic in how he brings in inter-ethnic, interracial dialogue, where we assume that, okay, there are tips and tricks to communicating, but layer on that diversity that comes to us because of our diversity of race, ethnicity, gender, politics, ideology. And so we also do a formal training in that. And I, having been here now for a year and a half, for me, it's very important that our brand is a nonpartisan brand, that as what we do as a school. I mean, we'll have speakers who are Republicans and Democrats, but the focus of our engagement with them is as public service leaders, not as the Democratic so-and-so or the Republican so-and-so. So I think that it's a holistic construction of how we try to train that next generation of leaders in terms of the hard skills, you're in the classroom, but also you're in the field, and it's a larger culture of tolerance and respect and intellectual curiosity of like, okay, I may not agree with you, but how do you approach this topic?
And that's a fascinating subject, because obviously as public service leaders, you're trying to influence people to go out into the world and create better communities, better societies. But it's sort of trying to take people who like Mexican food and then take people who like Asian food and say, both of you are right, and both of you have to work together to let the entire community here appreciate both types of cuisine, if we're using that analogy. But neither one of you is more right than the other one. How do you get leaders to drop their mind's better than yours or my idea is better than your idea and say it's okay to have your philosophy, your ideology, but don't force it on someone else? I mean, in some sense, it falls in almost back to the religious thing, a religious debate, it's
politics and religion.
Exactly. Right. The two things we don't talk about. Here we are. Right. But do you find that being easier or more difficult with the students that come through here and this mindset that they're in of that figuring out the world and wanting to go out and make a big change?
So I think it's a mixed bag because, and I'm not dogging on social media here, I think social media can do a lot of good, but just given our current state of information consumption, it's very easy to be tribalized. And so I think just our millennials, our Gen Zers are a little bit more attuned to that world that's very segmented. So I think that's one challenge. But on the flip side of that, I think younger folks, and we engage with a range of students from, 22 to 60s. But I think sometimes they're a little bit more open to, they're still like, okay, let me figure this out. Let me learn. But on an institutional level, this idea of how do we get this person over here who believes one thing and this person over here who believes another thing to come together. And this is something that I actively work on at the national level, at the professional level. Actually, I was just working on this earlier today, working with a group of deans from peer institutions, from American University, Carnegie Mellon, where we're going to be hosting dinner salons, where the guest list is curated to where we know that folks from diverse backgrounds, diversity again writ large, and we come together with very well-trained moderators, people like our faculty member Dr. Robert Richards, to start to have these conversations in safe places that, we're not going to be, like that cable news show type of format, but where we wine you, we dine you, but we also give you a little bit of space to stretch your boundaries. I think that is something that I'm very excited about, and I would like to then kind of extend out into the community the work that we do and we're trained to do, and then extend that out. I also think that there's some really great curriculum that we're seeing more and more undergraduate institutions, even high school institutions, bring in into understanding the emotion that goes into processing information. So a lot of times the reason we don't come to the middle is because we let emotion infuse so much of it. So how do you diffuse the emotion of that and talk about the facts and agree to disagree on the facts before just letting it get into a shouting match and nobody wins? So that is something that personally for me is very important, and it's something that the school is also institutionally working toward at a larger scale, but also through our day-to-day with our students.
That's a lot. That sounds interesting. I'd love to be a fly on the wall at some of those dinners.
All right.
Okay.
Coming to you this summer.
There we go. I'll bring the wine.
Okay.
Okay. So I want to look kind of big picture. Obviously, the namesake of the school sitting right next to the Clinton Presidential Library. If anybody looks at the 90s, you can see the stamp of President Clinton all over the place. And if you've been to the Presidential Library, you realize it's more than just the politics. It's a lot more than that. There's so much that was done that you know, every president has the opportunity to do. But I think President Clinton, by and large, is one of those that anybody can look at and see the work that was done globally, not just on U.S. soil. So how do you take that legacy and push it out into the world? Is that part of the mission here, is to continue on, obviously, the namesake of the school, but the ideology of what was done to impact the world beyond the politics?
Yes, an emphatic yes in that. So starting with, and we discussed that President Clinton's vision was to have a school of public service so that folks from across sectors, because if you look at his work, he was very engaged in, you know, from the DNA project into NAFTA and free trade and foreign policy. So, I mean, his range of impact is probably one of the widest we've ever seen. So that also informs why this is about building a toolkit and not focusing on just foreign policy, for example. The other piece of that, though, is we are unique in that we blend domestic and international policy. So most of our peer institutions have tracks. They have the domestic track and they have the international track. President Clinton said, look, there are no issues that are unique to one country, to one boundary. So if we're going to have our leaders being well-equipped to confront any challenge, whether they never leave the state of Arkansas or if they end up going to Uganda to do work, we want to make sure they have that. So each of our students, after their first year, so between their first and second year, do an IPSP, an International Public Service Project. So all of our students go abroad. This summer I was talking to our director of field service. We've got some of our students going to the Syrian Refugee Network, some of our students doing work with the UN. So all types of organizations. Again, that model of field service where they're paired with a partner, so it's an active learning experience, they're learning, but they get to go across the world. And I think that is so key, because that idea of a global leader, even if you're not, you know, leaving the country or leaving the state, but nowadays our whole world is infused with that international mindset.
It's really cool. On a personal note, I'm curious. So growing up in Arizona, living all over the country, getting to come have this incredible job, one of the things that I've found really interesting through the work I get to do is the number of people I've met that were part of the administration that are from right here in mostly central Arkansas, but generally all over the state. Do you ever fangirl over anybody? Do you see people and you're like, oh my gosh?
Yes, absolutely. Like, I am that political nerd. I've read about you, and then I And then, you know, I meet you. But I think for me, probably one of the most surreal experiences, and again, I'm this kid from the border. Like, who am I? And I remember saying, okay, you know, I'd done my interview. I'd come to Little Rock. I'd met with the faculty and President Bobbitt. And then they said, okay, well, the last stage of the interview process is President Clinton is going to have a phone interview with all of the finalists. I was like, oh my gosh, what? Talk about pressure. And I was very nervous at the beginning. And then after maybe the first 5 or 6 minutes, I was in nerdy glee. You know, because President Clinton is such a policy wonk and is so well read and just starts talking about the most interesting things. And I like stood outside of myself. I said, I'm talking to President Bill Clinton about policy, about the stuff that I have dedicated my life to studying and to analyzing. So it is very surreal. And it's just great to meet folks, because the folks that you meet, they're very excited about that next generation of leaders. So again, I have the coolest job.
So what makes, other than getting to, you know, speak with President Clinton, what makes you really get excited on a daily basis?
Our alumni. Our alumni are all so different, as I mentioned earlier, but they have such incredible stories. Literally 2 minutes before this interview, I was meeting with an alumni from one of our first classes who is a pediatrician. And he was a full-fledged pediatrician working at Children's Hospital. And when he learned about this degree program, he came and he enrolled as a full-time student because he wanted to help children in Arkansas and children in, you know, the greater United States have better opportunities in terms of their health outcomes. So, you know, hearing these stories are so incredible. And we have a number of international students too, and the work that they do in impacting their communities. So that is probably one of my biggest joys, is engaging with our alumni community, which at this point, you know, we've graduated 17 classes. It has a really neat range of folks. So that, among many things.
So I typically steer away from the political conversation, but I'm curious to get your input on this. So I recently heard an interview with Matthew McConaughey, UT alum.
Yes.
And there's been rumblings of his potential political ambitions.
Yes.
But the interview basically went something along the lines of, he said, the microphones have been held with the polarizing ends for far too long, and the numbers show that most of us are centrists. We're in the middle, but you know, this is his perspective. But I'm just kind of curious, because I also heard Governor Mike Beebe on one of his last few months in office as the governor of Arkansas. We were about to do an interview with him, and we were asking him how his day went, and he said, well, I feel like I'm one of the only conservatives left in this building. And it was the irony of him being a Democrat. But his point was, to get anything done, you have to come together. Mm-hmm. You can't get up on a mic, be a polarizing individual, and expect to get anything done. Yeah. Now, that may be how you get elected, but that's mm-hmm. not how you get anything done. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to just kind of get your global take on where the country is, because it's been very polarized over the last 6-7 years. And regardless of which side yeah. you're on, I think, and I'm one of those people that I see the world as much more gray than it is black and white. And I can see positives and negatives on both sides of almost any issue. And it doesn't mean I don't care about things. It means I understand mm-hmm. things from both sides. And I think there's a lot of people out there like that. So when we're trying to get things done, we're trying to lead and make change and create change, sometimes people just listen to the person with the mic and think that's what I have to do or not do. It's this or that. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to get your take on what you see in the global atmosphere of politics right now, and how do we ignore the loud screaming ends and bring things more towards the middle.
Whew, that's a heavy one.
Let's keep it light.
just some light fare.
That's right.
So I'm going to come at this with my political scientist hat. And you are absolutely right in that when you look at the numbers, when you look at the polls, at the opinion polls, at where people stand on issues, the vast majority of the American public is in that middle. The extremes are about a quarter over here on the left, a quarter on the right. But the challenges that we have in that the middle not being heard, I see a couple of factors, and I'll put those on the table. The first is institutionally. One of my biggest frustrations is with how our electoral lines are drawn, where that polarization that we experience today, and you're absolutely right, it's two ends of the spectrum yelling at each other with lots of microphones, is our elected representatives are smart. And they know that if they want to get reelected, that they're just going to cater to the bulk of their population. And as we draw districts that are more and more homogeneous, that are tightly D or tightly R, that incentive to work across the aisle at the political level, at the high level of policy disappears. And then I see that trickling down. So I think institutionally, that is a serious issue. If I had a magic wand, I would see more nonpartisan commissions that draw lines based more on geography, more on communities. I also am not a huge fan of the primary system. I would like to see where you have kind of the top two vote getters and they go into a runoff, or the top four, because the electoral primary system pulls to the extremes. The incentives are on going to the extremes. I think those are two institutional pieces. I think in terms of media, we've seen so many advancements in the technology that carries forth our media, but we don't see a commensurate media literacy. We're not teaching our children or our youth how to figure out, you know, what is real news, what is fake news, and I think that also contributes to that. So I think those are my biggies that I always point to, because, and the good news to that is that I think that they are addressable. They are addressable in terms of how we structure our primary systems, our redistricting systems, and also, this is a little bit more at the local level, is how we engage our communities to be more conscientious consumers of information. And alongside of that, I'm going to put in the fact that I think places like the Clinton School have a responsibility to be places where we intentionally bring people together because we are so polarized, and kind of help foster that middle and even try to bring those two extremes in a little closer.
I love it. So what I'm hearing you say is we need to have a college basketball March Madness type political runoff instead of
yes, we have the brackets. Exactly. We have. I mean, hey, I'm a big college basketball fan, so I'm willing to give it a try.
Let's do it. All right, you heard it here first, folks. No, so you're leading this school that's going out and essentially changing the world. Let's just
yes, I will take that because it's true.
It's true. So let's talk about you for a second and what. What's your mind? How do you stay in the right mindset to make sure that you're doing the right things for both the faculty and the students? What are some of your personal daily routines or challenges that you try and overcome early in the morning or late at night to make sure that you're always in the right headspace to step in the school and do the right thing?
So it's going to be early in the morning, because by about 8:30 I'm done. I'm probably falling asleep by 8:30. And on that, I have always been a morning person, and in the morning is where I can check off what I need to do. I can engage deeply in different projects. I can think through things that I need to think through, because 6:30-ish rolls around and my 8 and 9-year-old are up. And that's a big pause until I get to school. But once I'm at school, I want to be focused on the stakeholders, the students, the faculty, my advisory board member, external stakeholders. So that warning is really important because that allows me to feel that I'm pushing forward the projects I need to be pushing forward, and it doesn't detract from my engagement when I am here at the Clinton School or when I'm traveling and I'm meeting with different students, different stakeholders. You know, my time is stretched thin, and I don't sleep as much as I would like, you know, because of the job and the family. But at the same time, I think that having a young family, having, you know, an incredible husband, having, you know, an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old, and my mother also lives here in the community, gives me balance and a check, and it pulls me away. Because if anyone can become a workaholic really easily. And I think that it's not always quantity, but quality. Like, sure, I could work 18-hour days, but would I have that perspective? And I know that I really try to keep the weekends, unless we have an event or something, or there's an emergency, I try to keep that space personal. I'm not emailing my faculty or folks on the weekend, at least I try to, so that I can come back on Monday with a fresh lens. And I encourage my faculty and my staff and my students to do the same. Give yourself a break, because if not, you're going to wear yourself out and you're not going to be able to show up with your 100% to this arena.
That's awesome. So we kind of mentioned earlier how you have the opportunity to meet some really interesting and fascinating people. Who are, as I call them, the titans in your life that kind of shape and influence who you are and who you would like to be?
The titans. Oh, that's a good question. All right, so I think first and foremost, my parents. My parents were, my father recently passed away, but my mother, they didn't know exactly what I was doing most of the time. They're like, student council, what's that? Political science, what's that? But they always propelled me forward. So I think having that pillar of power within them was critical. One of my graduate school mentors, Dr. John Aldrich, is another pillar. I mean, I know this is going to sound cheesy and cliche, but Bill Clinton, you know, being a person who came of age in the 1990s, President Bill Clinton had a tremendous impact on, you know, my day-to-day of the things happening around me. And, you know, fast forward 25 years, here I am. So I think he is a titan in my life because of that, but also because I very much share his vision about the school, about who we are. There are just so many people. I am someone who is fortunate to have many kitchen cabinets and many councils of elders, because you can't do this alone. You can't lead alone. And you have to find those people in your life that they may not be an overlooming titan like my parents or a graduate mentor, but are your micro mentors that for certain situations you're like, I don't know what the heck I'm doing, but I think I know someone who does. So I think I, over the years, have been very conscientious about seeking out micro mentorship opportunities and also making myself available to do the same.
So you've got to have something. I mean, you're obviously very ambitious, very driven. If you look down the road 25 years, what's the thing you want to look back on and say, that was the thing I wanted to make sure I did? What's the big goal that you're working towards?
The big goal, 25 years, that's a big chunk. I've got
10
the
years,
five and 10
five.
Years. All right, we'll do that.
We can slow it down.
The 10 to 20. So I am very excited about the growth of the Clinton School. So the Clinton School is still a young school, especially when you compare it to, you know, your East Coast schools, some more established Midwestern schools. So we have been small, focused on high touch and high impact. What I want to do is I want to keep that goodness of high touch and high impact, but just expand it out. I want to double our enrollment, so that we still have that intimate feel, but that we are multiplying that good that we do. So I think that is the most concrete goal that I have, is expanding that out, because each one of our alumni have such tremendous multiplicative impact, that is what I want to see. And alongside that is I want us to become a school that readily attracts folks from around the country as well as around the globe. Arkansas is an incredible place, and people should be coming here. You know, we need to be equipping our native Arkansans with this fantastic tool, but we also have such goodness here that I want to be a magnet for top talent across the country.
Yeah, and if you look at what business is doing, obviously in the public sector, there's so much heritage and history and great examples of ways to do things. There's no reason people shouldn't come, and it's cheap compared to so many places.
And that's great. It's for graduate institutions, that's a selling point for me because, you know, you're a poor student, you know, you're paying tuition. Do you really want to go to Washington, D.C., to one of the most expensive cities in the world? So this is literally the argument that I use all the time with our graduate students, prospective graduate students, because it is such a great place to live, both in terms of cost of living, but also community, and when you're at the stage in your career of gaining that toolkit.
Yeah, I have a good friend who ultimately took a job in D.C. With Winrock International.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he left here, took a 33% pay increase, but took a standard of living decrease because the amount of money he was just spending every month to live there, he didn't have as much money to go out and do things and travel and do what he wanted to do. So he came back and he's back in Arkansas.
He made the case for me.
Exactly. Okay, so when you are able to wind down and not be working towards that big goal, where do you go? What do you do? Do you have favorite vacation spots, or are you a homebody? What's your thing?
I a little of all. as I mentioned earlier, my mother's family's from northern Mexico. So for spring break, we went down and visited the family. So that's really special for me, even though, you know, we're geographically far apart, but to still have that connection to the Southwest. So that's on the list. That's always kind of once or twice a year. My husband is a big beach person, so we always do one big beach vacation a year. With the kids who are now a little bit older, we want to make sure that we're doing family vacations that are age appropriate, but also engaging. So this summer we're going to Morocco.
Oh, nice.
We're doing a National Geographic tour, and so I think that we want to do stuff that gives us a little bit of downtime relaxation, a little bit of beach time, family time, but also exploration time. So I think we try to mix it up.
And that cultural engagement that gives you a new perspective on the world. I think that's so important. And of course, I think all of us, the older we get, the more important we realize that is. We're slowly working on a project where hopefully we can start influencing people to get outside their norm of, you know, 30A every summer or every spring break, you know. It's great. We love it. It's fun. But let's branch out. Let's go do something different and explore different cultures and realize the world's a much bigger place than one strip of sand.
And especially post-COVID,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that we didn't realize what we had in terms of mobility until we lost it.
Yep.
And so I think, at least for us, it's let's go. I mean, let's pick a place that we've never been, and let's do our research and go.
So as we kind of round third base here, as we all can analyze the world and the positives and the negatives, which it seems like if you turn the news on or scroll social media, the world's falling apart all the time. What's the one thing that gives you hope in humanity?
Students. I mean, there's a reason why I never left school. I never left. I went straight through, and then I went back into academia because, for me, being in the classroom, being in an educational setting, gives me that hope that is very easily pulled away when you turn on the news, when you talk to people. I think there's also just especially, again, talking about COVID, a generalized funk. But you talk to students who want to change the world and have such incredible ideas and the motivation to do so. And that's what gives me hope. So I'm selfish in doing what I do. I mean, you're not taking me away from here.
But that's great. That's what keeps the passion and the vision pointed forward and allows you to achieve the things you want to achieve, which is a noble cause.
I would like to think so, and that's why I also think I'm so lucky.
All right, I want to move into just some quick hit, rapid-fire questions. Okay. The fun, easy stuff. So first and foremost, are you Netflix or the news? When you sit down in front of TV.
What, Netflix? Actually, no, telenovelas.
Okay.
Yes, I watch like my Univision. I tape my soap operas and then when I have a chance, I watch them. So neither.
All right, that's fair. That's a good answer. What is the latest book you've read, or if you're not a big reader, what's the best book you've ever read? But I'm assuming you're a big reader.
Yeah, I just finished this book, and I'm blanking on the name, but it's by Jonas Jonasson. It's essentially about the adventures of this 100-year-old guy who escapes the old folks' home and goes on to have all of these fabulous adventures.
Nonfiction or fiction?
It's fiction.
Okay.
Jonas Jonasson, and I will get you the title of it. It is probably one of the most enjoyable reads. I mean, I enjoy all my books, but just fun and engaging and laugh out loud.
So as a follow-up to that one, if you could write your own book, and maybe have you written books before?
I've written articles and book chapters, but the book not yet.
Well, if you were to write a book, or if you were to go buy a billboard on 630 out here, what would the title of the book be, or what would your message on a billboard be?
That be? Oh man, it'd be a boring one. It would be, again, focused on public service education. Because I think that's something that we talk about a lot, public service education, but there really isn't a pedagogy as well-formed as you would think. So I think in terms of my long-term view is building out a book for people like me, that we've kind of created it as we've gone along, but I want to codify that into a book. And I'd be a terrible fiction writer, so I'm not going to give you some fun, interesting fiction. That's why I read fiction. I could never write fiction.
Best piece of advice you've either given or received?
So my husband gave me this piece of advice a long time ago. He said, listen to what people don't say.
Dive into that.
You're engaging with people and you're listening to what they're saying, but on a certain topic, they're ultimately things they're holding back. And what people don't say about a person, a situation, can be as informative as what they're saying, because what they're saying is curated. But what they're not saying, I think there's a lot in there that you need to take into consideration, that you don't just focus on what's there, but also focus on the negative space.
So we've already hit this question, but next vacation you want to go on, Morocco is where you're going, but what's a place on the map you haven't been that you really want to go?
Antarctica. I mean, Antarctica, because it is the polar opposite of what I grew up with, right? I grew up in the desert. And so I think that is one, I mean, just a wondrous voyage that I would love to take with my family. But aside from that, everywhere. I want to be able to travel across the globe. I want to learn. I'm a perpetual student. So I think anywhere I haven't gone, I'm pretty interested in going.
Speaking of going, what's the next concert you want to go to, or your favorite band or musician?
One of my favorite bands or musicians is Morrissey. But I don't think he has any concerts coming up. Having spent a lot of time in Texas and in Austin, I became a big fan of Shiny Ribs. And some friends said that he's coming again. He came last year, I believe. So if he is coming again, that's where you'll find me.
Awesome. Yeah. Favorite meal, favorite type of food?
Oh, I just love food. I do. I love food. I love to cook. Probably going back to my roots, who I am. I'm a Mexican-Italian. I'm part Jewish too, but didn't engage in that cuisine as much with my grandma Shirley, but tacos and chimichangas, and then on the Italian side, the bruschetta and the gnocchi. And so But then again, Middle Eastern food, I love French cuisine, I love, give me anything that's tasty and I will happily eat it.
Now, are you the type of person that you'll eat the fish with the fish head on
it?
Sure. Like, you know, none of that weirds you out?
No. When we were in Mexico, I was so excited that I got to have my tacos de sesos, which is, this is TMI, but it's brains, but they're stewed and it's delicious. And I got my fix. So I'll try. When I say I'll try anything, I'll try anything.
I love it. Well, Vicki, this has been fantastic. I appreciate you taking the time. If you could leave one last message with people, how can they find out more about the Clinton School or what you guys are doing?
Well, first of all, visit our website, clintonschool.edu, and reach out to me. I think that personal engagement is what is most important. So if you are interested in learning about the Clinton School and the work we do, my door is always open, and my faculty, my staff, my students, our community knows that. So reach out to me personally, and if I can't answer your question, I have someone who will.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. This was fun. Thank you, guys.
If you liked this episode of Titans of Industry, head to contenttitan.co/podcast for more episodes or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. Thanks for listening.